Welcome to the podcast. You're with Katina Michael, Associate Professor at the University of Wollongong in Australia. Some of the more sensitive issues surrounding big data include data ownership, copyright, and privacy. The big data industry is a multi-billion dollar industry, and there is a lot at stake both with respect to ICT companies as suppliers and government agencies who rely on big data for decision making. Citizens are continually challenged to become aware of the issues that are likely to affect them, such as the secondary use of medical data records and even the use of drones and other emerging video capture technologies. To speak to us, we have Professor Marcus Wiggin, a very experienced researcher and a multiple specialist in a diverse number of fields. He is Professor Emeritus of Transport and Information Systems and also has posts in Sustainable Society and ICT and Civil Engineering. Welcome to the program, Marcus.
Thank you, Katina.
Can you give us a context for various big data topics?
Big data's been growing on us for a long time, and big data is the result of a move from paucity of data and information to an overwhelming volume. We haven't adapted to this. The legal system hasn't. Individuals haven't. Community hasn't. People are exploiting various aspects of it without understanding that big data, like any large information system, has a major vulnerability for people. Linkages, roll up your history.
One of the least discussed areas of this new data-driven innovation world emerging has to do with data ownership. We're in desperate need of that conversation. Can you summarize it for us?
It starts by the identification of the fact that the tokens that identify us, and in fact we're required to use to confirm our identity, we own none of them. They're owned by other parties. So in a real sense, we don't even own ourselves. It's not surprising, therefore, that there are confusions about who owns the data about us when our very identity is not our own.
Okay, let's tease that out a bit. An emerging innovation like wearable computers, I'm wearing a wearable computer, I'm walking down the road, I'm recording others and being recorded. What can we say about who owns that particular data on the device?
Well, we start off by saying that in public places you have no expectation of privacy. That's a well-established legal principle. However, nobody's ever really faced up to the fact that this information you're acquiring, which you then, in the sense of photography, then own. However, if it gets flicked to Google, does Google own it? Well, they'll certainly assert that they have the use of it. Does it matter if they own it, if they have the access to it? These are the sorts of problems that haven't been teased out. Single photographs. Have you ever noticed that if you take a photograph of something in a public place, somebody is sure to come up and say, you didn't ask my permission? It happens frequently. And yet they have no such rights. All we're doing is putting this on stilts.
I go back to that famous book by Anne Branscombe on who owns information, and can see where you're going with that argument. Do you think most people are aware of the data sovereignty issue with respect to things like cloud computing? You mentioned, you know, someone taking a video, putting it up into the cloud, and then losing perhaps strict ownership of it. What is the difference between data sovereignty and data ownership?
Data sovereignty essentially limits the legal uses of data. However, in a global situation, constituency shopping is normal in tax events. It's not surprising it's also used for data events. The internal nature of processing of data will always leave people who process data obtained in any way, and I mean any way, as owning it in some sense. Only data registration, stricter laws which allow a right of ownership of one's own identity and other factors, which have not been put in place, can deal with that. One of the few ways that you can actually deal with it ex post is to say, I want the right to delete data that pertains to me, when in fact you don't own it. The EU is struggling with that kind of principle right now. This is the difficulty in even using the words of sovereignty and ownership.
So we have a lot of people disclosing personal information on things like social networks and a lot of companies rushing to actually bring out new innovations around web scraping technologies that are able to perhaps analyze data on the fly without taking a copy of that data and putting it somewhere and then analyzing it and therefore circumventing the ownership issues. What kind of world are we actually walking into with that respect?
This is precisely the reason why I was careful in defining what I meant. The processing of the data is deemed in some senses to be an ownership. And in fact, if you sit there and you analyze something and you produce some results, well, you do own that, don't you? So what's the difference with personal data? And that's the perceptions that people have. And remember that the TRIPS protocol says that assemblages of completely open and unowned data may have copyright in themselves. We are still reaping the whirlwind of the TRIPS protocols from the early 90s. And all of these can be used and deployed to defend those who wish to analyze data that they will claim as public. However, while that's pretty reasonable in some senses, the difficulty is it's the linkage with other sources. And when you have really large big data sources, identification and re-identification of anonymized data becomes remarkably straightforward, as unfortunately is being increasingly shown. So once again, if we have any rights to our own identity, we might be able to go through this chain. But that's a fearfully difficult issue. There's no global agreement as to what comprises a description of identity, let alone an ownership for it. And until we do that, what control do we have when it goes outside our hands, as you so well described?
Talk to us a bit about those different and diverse technologies. I mean, you're a professor of transport and ICT, and I know you've done a lot of research in various technology uses. But tell us, you know, what are those hot innovations out there that are doing the data collection?
I think I'm going to go backwards. I'm going to say this was actually anticipated in the 80s. I remember being asked to write about it, and in fact, I've got to give credit to Tolling Roads Corporation for actually asking me the question. And that's an unusually far-sighted question for an operational authority. They said, what will happen when the traffic technologies become universal and extensive? In other words, when you are identifiable, when your number plates are identifiable, when the data can be integrated, when we can work fast enough to identify you in real time out of a huge cloud of information, when we can look back at your history of where you've been and when you've been there, what should we do? And it was a very good question. And my answer to that at the time, which is now 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, was to say, unless you design systems that do not have the capacity to do this, it will be assumed by people that it will be done. This has come to pass. However, that principle is now known as privacy by design, and privacy by design is far from a plentiful process in operations. So when we introduce new technologies, we're not changing anything apart from the fact of making it even easier and more confused as who owns it, who accesses it. What do you do with your Google Glass, Katina? Do you keep the data? Do you link it to everybody you see without their permission to their Facebook pages? These questions won't be theoretical within a year.
Absolutely fascinating. And I know you've done some research into smart meters in Victoria, Australia. And we had another podcast on smart grids and big data. Can you provide us some insight into this aspect of big data with respect to smart meters?
A perfectly timed question in this sequence. The smart meters are essentially simple computers that monitor power usage. Most of them can, if properly set up, identify individual devices and control them from the other end. The power distributors and power generators see them as simply part of their system. The data that's generated, they see as theirs. And indeed, if you read the privacy principles for most smart meter using distributors, they require you to accept that fact by clicking on any privacy principle or acceptance. So I can't even use my own web access to look at my own smart meter. The reason for this is simple. The regulation of such bodies lies in the hands of energy regulators and competition parties. And so the stakeholder groups don't include community. They certainly don't include people like Electronic Frontiers. And they just think they've consulted when they have not done so. So they're going on oblivious, working on the assumption and the framework, just like we discussed the 20-year-old one. And so we're now getting the effect. So we now have the very real possibility that identification of which device you're using when and what your presence is and how quickly you leave home and what your patterns are being owned by your power distributor. Interesting situation. since they have every right to sell such information at present, and I'm sure they've arranged to do so.
Well, we've talked now about the potential. It's almost like anticipatory behavioural tracking based on historical data, almost live situational awareness in some instances. You know, I exit my house, I switch off the lights, then I'm no longer home. What are some of the consequences we can imagine may be brought forth by an exponential growth of big data on the average citizen?
There are two trends that are converging. One is big data and its collection, which is what you've raised, and the other one is a somewhat alarming trend where civil society law and intelligence national security imperatives are being confused. So with access to big data, intelligence and enforcement agencies are seeking access to it, with great success, I might add, even in Australia. And as a result, it's changing the rules as to how such information is integrated. So we now have a situation where, and it's well established that most people have a routine that perhaps 8 or 9 routines would describe most of the locations and most of the activities and most of the timings in the day. And that's recently been rediscovered in the big data publishing, but it was known for a long time in transport. So you really don't need very much to anticipatory review. So one of the classic intelligence techniques is, of course, to identify which people use a particular slot in time and space, even when you're not present, because that can establish associations. This becomes a trivial task. And that's an example of the crossover between civil society, guilt after proof, assumptions of innocence, and assumptions of identification on partial information. When those two get confused, we have a serious problem in even being able to frame the question, do we use national security law? Do we use civil law? What can we do to undo it? How can we actually disclose it? And the difficulty is that this roller coaster is running at a rate that law is barely capable to comprehend, let alone respond to. So we can confidently say that the expansion of big data and big data collection is going to produce an absolutely legalistic nightmare within countries, let alone the international ones.
So what do you say to the argument from what's been dubbed the Gen Z generation, that content-hungry YouTube generation, that says the times are a-changing, get with the times, people don't mind disclosing personal information anymore, and that transparency is the only way forward?
I love idealism. It's one of the characteristics of youth that I find most entertaining. It rarely survives, as has been said in military worlds, contact with the enemy. And with youth, they have not had contact with the enemy. It's amazing how those attitudes change when you explain to exactly that generation how the information is being used. I have observed the immediate response of this generation is to shut down every privacy setting they have. Let me give you a practical example. I joined Facebook solely to find out who my daughter's friends were. I did it, I told her, and the natural effect was she shut down all the privacy settings, which was the real objective. So I think that when you talk about this new generation, we're talking about people brought up in an environment that's data-rich, connection-rich, but they have not yet discovered the price. And the price of history is to have to recapitulate it, as many people have said. The difficulty is that they have indelible histories now. And even their friends may tag them on Facebook pictures without their knowledge, with pictures they didn't know were taken, and those linkages are meat and drink to the marketers. They have yet to discover the price. They are beginning to. Jobs are disappearing from them. Facebook searches and other equivalent searches on Google. And as mass data grows and the inevitable leaks from health records come, would you really want to pay for insurance anymore? It's a contract of utmost good faith, remember? I think it's going to destroy the insurance industry unless there's some very substantial changes in law. The first one we've seen is the ruling against genetic data in the US. But of course, in Australian law, if you have the information, the insurance company must has every right to know about it. So don't collect your genetic information if you don't want the insurance company to use it. That is an example of the slow adaptability to mass data. And there's nothing much bigger than genetic information, is there, really?
In your paper, Marcus, with Roger Clark, Professor at ANU, you've proposed a description of these issues within a framework you've dubbed Private Data Commons and Community Data Commons, and I want you really to elaborate on what you mean by that.
The classic Brundtland report, which really established for the world what the commons were, namely the things that everybody could have access to, and when abrogated by individuals, everybody loses. I couldn't think of a better description of what happens to the data space. We had access to the data space. The web opened it up for us. We could share it. We could put information there. We could find things. But unfortunately, that commons is now being monetized. We have no rights and no principles and no mechanisms for discussing the loss of this space. So by analogy with the environmental argument, I felt it was appropriate to put forward a private data space that in fact one has to protect in both a social and a practical way, a space in which data can be used and shared. If we are to benefit from big data, some such principles need to be established internationally. Now, the reason why we added community data space is that generally individuals only have a certain amount of data that they want to keep. I mean, you know, a few hundred terabytes, and I'm not joking about that. If you look, you'll find it is. But the real power comes in sharing, but the control of that sharing means that a community data space is needed. But if that gets nibbled away, monetized, leaked, re-identified, repurposed, then we lose it. And that's what we're losing now. And one, some people might put it the other way, the Google and Facebook takeover of the web. Now, that's a half-formed thought. If you think about it more, we want that shared space. It's a community asset, a huge community asset. But we've allowed it to go into the commercialized area, and slowly and inevitably it's monetized. And we already discussed the problem of data ownership, use, and rights. We don't have any, barely have any, certainly internationally. So these are the sorts of issues which the law needs to start to tackle. We know it won't take place until too late, but it must start now. Therefore, a private data commons provides a shorthand form of saying there is a space in this new cyber world which is of enormous value to individuals and communities, but only if they can own parts of it.
I'd like to thank you, Marcus, for those invaluable insights. Decades of research into this area from your own volition and in much of it an honorary capacity, or most of it I should say. Sometimes I think it's the only way to get at these issues, to work at them on your own without sponsorship. You've worked tirelessly on numerous committees and boards in Australia, and over decades I've seen your work particularly in non-government organisations. But I commend you for all that tireless work and unpaid work. But it has given you the freedom to explore these areas which are much in demand today with respect to regulation and data governance. Thank you so much.
Do what you need to do and then find something to pay for some of it.